Hello and welcome to Science World. As honeybees continue to mysteriously disappear, one U.S. government biologist is doing his part in trying to preserve the memory of many bee species before some become extinct. We'll hear how an obesity specialist is coming to the aid of an 8-month-old boy from Colombia who weighs over 20 kilograms. That's 3 times heavier than an average child of that age. There's big health news this past week for those living in developing countries. Scientists have developed a revolutionary nanovaccine that does not require refrigeration or booster shots. And a group of scientists from California and China released a new study this past week that explains why Earth has remained habitable despite natural events that have robbed other planets in our solar system of their ability to host and sustain life. We'll hear from the lead author of the study. We have these stories and more coming your way on VOA Science Health and Technology Magazine, Science World. Scientists have developed a revolutionary vaccine that does not require refrigeration or booster shots, making the so-called nanovaccine a potential game changer in curbing disease in the developing world. Experts believe the drug could extend immunization to millions of people who are not now vaccinated against dangerous infectious diseases. Jessica Berman reports.
Scientists say the vaccine is the first to use nanoparticles, a relatively new technology in medicine that embeds proteins from disease-causing organisms into tiny polymer spheres 500 times smaller than the width of a human hair. Balaji Narasimhan, a chemical engineer at Iowa State University, led a team of researchers that developed the nasal spray. Like other vaccines, the protein-containing nanoparticles contained in the spray prime the body's immune system to recognize and mount a protective response against dangerous diseases without actually causing illness. Narasimhan says a huge advantage of the nanovaccine is that it does not require refrigeration, which is challenging in remote parts of the world and drives up the cost of traditional vaccines.
The price of the vaccine would go down, but the logistics of deploying these vaccines into various parts of the world would also be tremendously impacted by a room temperature storage vaccine that would not need refrigeration.
Narasimhan says nanovaccines developed in the lab remained effective for up to 6 months without refrigeration. A nanovaccine can be designed to target any disease, according to Narasimhan, by sealing proteins from the pathogens inside the spheres. Researchers have so far developed experimental vaccine sprays against influenza and pneumonia, as well as a number of bioterrorism agents, including plague and anthrax. Narasimhan says designer nanovaccines could potentially be used to contain emerging infectious diseases such as SARS, new influenza strains, and drug-resistant tuberculosis. They can even be formulated to include antibiotics and antimicrobials to help treat disease. A person only needs to be immunized once with a nanovaccine. Narasimhan says boosters are not needed to resensitize the immune system against a disease because of the way the nanoparticles work.
When they come into contact with the body fluids, water mainly, degrades the particles. And so as the particles degrade, they release that protein slowly. So that slow release of the protein is what essentially gives the body the type of memory that it requires to remember the infection and obviates the need for a booster shot.
Narasimhan envisions someday having nanovaccines against any number of tropical diseases, including cholera, diphtheria, and dengue fever, once researchers identify target proteins. Balaji Narasimhan unveiled his nanovaccine at the annual meeting of the American Chemical Society in Dallas, Texas. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
While the collapse of honeybee colonies in North America is still an unsolved mystery, a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey is trying to preserve the memory of thousands of varieties of pollinating insects, some of which may become extinct. George Butich has more.
A mysterious phenomenon known as colony collapse disorder is devastating honeybee populations all over the world. Conservationists say some of North America's 4,000 bee species could be wiped out. Rutgers University researcher Rachel Winfrey, talking to VOA via Skype, says honeybees are not the only pollinators in danger.
What we've found is that the native wild insects are doing about half of the flower visitation.
A scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, Sam Drogue, says bees are too beautiful to be forgotten if they vanish forever. So with the help of a lab technician, he is making full-color portraits of them.
When you look at our native species, you're talking metallic colors, metallic green, blues, blacks with heavy pitting, some are highly armored, some are red.
Drogue is photographing not only the domesticated honeybees, but also many of the wild species that pollinate crops. He collects some of the specimens himself, while others are sent to him by government agencies, researchers, and institutions across the country. Before their photo session, the bees must be washed and dried. Drogue positions them in a special white box that bounces the light, leaving no shadows. The photographs taken from multiple angles are merged by a computer program into a single beautiful picture. Drogue says his work has two components.
One component is simply scientific, so the idea is it illustrates our identification guides, which are very technical and are going to only be seen by a small number of people. But the other aspect is sort of as a vehicle for talking about and illustrating all the beauty that is the huge variety of 4,000 different species of native bees.
Drogue says the detailed photos will help researchers by saving them time and preventing identification errors. Some of the pictures are available at the U.S. Geological Survey website. George Butich, VOA News, Washington.
An 8-month-old boy made headlines in Colombia after weighing in at over 20 kilograms. That's 3 times heavier than an average child of that age. With more, here's Science World's Martin Seacrest.
El niño pesa como un niño de 5 años.
The baby, Santiago, weighs the same as a 5-year-old child. So 3 normal-sized Santiagos would fit in him because he weighs 21 kilograms for an 8-month-old baby, and he should be weighing roughly 8 or 7 kilograms.
The child, Santiago, has been put on a strict diet by doctors to get his weight down to around 8 kilograms. Santiago will be taken off formula milk and fed vegetables and juices as part of the diet. Santiago's mother sought the help of a charity that tackles obesity in Colombia after she noticed the baby had problems moving about due to his weight. According to a foundation, there's no medical reason for Santiago's weight gain. He has just been overfed. For Science World, I'm Martin Seacrest.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear from the lead author of a new study that provides an explanation to why Earth has been able to remain habitable, something that other planets in our solar system have been unable to do. Scientists have developed a principle that helps explain why some planets can host life while others can't. That principle we're talking about is named after a classic fairy tale. For today's Science World Quick Quiz, we'd like to know from the following, what is the name of that fairy tale? Is it A, Humpty Dumpty, B, Little Miss Muffet, or C, Goldilocks and the Three Bears? Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in a few moments from now.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Antarctica is the coldest, driest, and windiest place on Earth, but plants can take root there and survive. As Roseanne Skirbel reports, a new study finds that moss can come back to life after centuries buried in the permafrost.
Signe Island off the Antarctic Peninsula is one of the richest wildlife habitats on the frozen continent. Each summer, when the ice retreats, it becomes a refuge for penguins and seabirds, and plants, especially mosses, return to life. It's here that Peter Convey, a scientist with the British Antarctic Survey, drills through the newly sprouted moss into the frozen ground to extract cores that will help him reconstruct the Earth's climate history. In this study, Convey's team wanted to know how far back in time, or down the core, the moss retained its ability to regenerate. Earlier research suggested that frozen plant material could be revived after 20 years at most.
So to look at it, we got a core. We sliced it in half down the middle, so lengthways, and put the halves in sterile boxes in a sort of standard growth incubator. And it turned out after about 3 to 4 weeks, you could see some new growth appearing in parts of the core.
That regenerated moss dated back 1,500 years. Other studies show that only microbes are capable of revival after so many years. Writing in the Cell Press journal Current Biology, Convey reports seeing plant shoots on the entire length of the 1.5-meter core.
And you can go further than that if you really want to. You can look at leaves on the shoot. And the leaves are pretty well perfectly preserved down the core as well. So one of the beauties of this sort of moss core is that you get a live surface, a growing surface. And then as you go down into the core, very quickly it becomes frozen in permafrost.
The moss survives so long in this deep freeze by building on the tolerance features it developed to flourish in the harsh Antarctic landscape. Convey says that survival mechanism has special relevance now in the context of climate change, as the polar regions warm faster than any other part of the globe.
Now, if we can imagine a situation where a moss bank like this gets covered over by ice, but the moss is viable in the permafrost underneath the ice, then as the ice recedes, you've actually got organisms in place that effectively are ready to go as soon as the ice goes away and their habitat becomes available again. So you've got a means of preserving diversity in the region.
And Convey asks, if moss can survive 1,500 years locked away in the permafrost, maybe it can last even longer through interglacial periods of 10,000 years or more. That's a subject for another study. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
The 2014 Major League Baseball season begins later this month. Every year before the regular season opens, teams prepare at training camps in Florida and Arizona. Professional baseball players have some of the best eyesight in the world, and scientists are documenting just how this vision leads to a winning game. Shelley Schlender has the story from Phoenix, Arizona.
At the Cleveland Indians training camp, the pitcher glares at the batter from the mound. He holds a white, fist-sized ball with red-stitched seams and throws it. A split second later, the batter swings and... Cleveland Indian Luigi Rodriguez says that to hit a baseball, you have to have focus.
The ball is a little bit small, so you gotta have good eyes, you know? Before the ball gets thrown, I look at the pitcher's arm, see where he's gonna throw the ball.
To see it all and process what they see quickly, ophthalmologist Daniel Labby says major league batters have some of the world's best eyesight.
The normal average person can see something from 3 meters, where the baseball players see it from 6 meters. They can be twice as far away and still see the same targets.
Labby is a pioneer in the science of sports vision, along with his colleague, ophthalmologist David Kirshen. Kirshen says they've published scientific papers on everything from major league vision to the eyesight of Olympians.
We had the opportunity to work with the vision for several sports, and it turns out it's a key component in some sports and not as important in others.
For example, athletes don't need amazing sight to dribble a basketball. For a hint about another sport, Kirshen makes his hands into fists, then throws a punch.
So if you think about a boxer, it's not necessarily important for them to have 20/20 vision, but they have to be able to move their hands very, very quickly.
Quick response is a key in most sports. But to hit a small, fast ball, Labby says great eyesight is fundamental.
And this will apply to cricket, and this can apply to tennis, and applies to really hockey, any fast-moving target sport.
Take baseball. Labby says that once a pitcher throws, the batter has less than one-tenth of a second to react.
That's a snap of the finger. Just when it's released from the pitcher's hand, they have to see the spin of the seams. And based on that spin pattern, they know what pitch it is. When you know what pitch it is, you know where it's going to come. Once you know where it's going to come, you can put the bat in the right place to make a good hit.
Batters work hard to improve judgment and reaction time. But to sharpen their natural vision, Labby and Kirshen often recommend corrective contact lenses. Their goal is to boost normal eyes into the super eyes needed for major league success. Like many of his teammates, Cleveland Indian player Jake Lowry wears contact lenses.
Helps me see the pitches, see the seams on a ball. Helps me keep the brightness down when the sun's out. Just helps me all around be able to see the pitches, see the scoreboard, see signs, everything.
To refine his prescription, the doctors ask Lowry to read a standard vision chart. However, identifying black letters on a white background checks focus, but nothing else. To track how quickly players react to more challenging targets, Labby and Kirshen have designed a test where a tiny and often faint letter C flashes on a computer screen, sometimes backwards or upside down. The athlete sits several meters away. Labby says this test might provide a better assessment for people taking driving tests, and it could also help budding baseball players, like 9-year-old Matthew, who came to the training camp to watch batting practice.
I want to be a baseball player when I grow up.
Labby says Matthew has a better chance of realizing his dream if his parents get his eyesight checked.
And if you have a young child who's interested in playing baseball, but they just don't see well enough, the coach won't spend as much time with that player as they will with the player who's doing very well.
He says testing eyesight and getting people the correction they need can help everyone do better at their game, whatever it is. For VOA News, I'm Shelley Schlender in Phoenix, Arizona.
Do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Let's find out. A few minutes ago, we asked, scientists have developed a principle that helps explain why some planets can host life while others can't. That principle is named after a classic fairy tale. From the following, what is the name of that fairy tale? Is it A, Humpty Dumpty, B, Little Miss Muffet, or C, Goldilocks and the Three Bears? Well, the correct answer is C, Goldilocks and the Three Bears. In case you forgot the story, a little girl named Goldilocks wanders into a house that's occupied by a family of bears who have gone into the woods on a hike. While they're out, Goldilocks decides to sample bowls of porridge that the three bears left on their table. After sampling each bowl, she finds the first bowl of porridge to be too hot, the second too cold, and the third was just right. Scientists sometimes use that tale to gauge a planet's ability to sustain life as we know it. For example, in our own solar system, Venus is too hot for us, while Mars is too cold. But Earth is just the right temperature for us. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
This past week, scientists from California and China released a new hypothesis that explains why Earth has remained habitable despite natural events that have robbed other planets in our solar system of their ability to host and sustain life. As the character Goldilocks exclaimed in the classic fairy tale, The Story of the Three Bears, Earth is the one planet in our solar system that's just right to maintain the ideal conditions for life to exist, unlike, for example, Mars, that's too cold, or Venus, that's too hot. Researchers gathered documented evidence to support their new theory that said one reason Earth has stayed livable is because of the various geologic cycles it's gone through over millions of years and continues to undergo today. These geologic cycles, which alternately release and then absorb atmospheric carbon dioxide, act as a form of climate control to keep the Earth in balance. Mark Torres from the University of Southern California is lead author of the study and joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about his team's research and findings. First of all, can you tell me what the Goldilocks principle is?
Oh, so the idea is there needs to be a certain amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. If you have too much, the Earth will get warm and get too hot. If you have too little, the Earth will get too cold, and also the organisms that use CO2 to photosynthesize, like plants, will not have enough CO2 to grow. So CO2 needs to be within a certain range in order for life to be happy at Earth's surface.
So the new hypothesis that you and your team developed explains why Earth has remained habitable for millions of years. Now, what does your theory say about that?
So the general idea is minerals react with water and atmospheric gases at Earth's surface. And since some minerals sequester CO2 or remove CO2 from the atmosphere, you can have an effect where if you supply more of those minerals to Earth's surface through uplifting a mountain, you might draw down CO2 from the atmosphere to levels that are too low for life on Earth. What we're saying is that, well, there's another reaction that occurs, that some minerals release CO2, and this effect is more pronounced in mountain ranges. So even if you uplift a mountain, you are not going to draw down CO2 so much that it'll affect life, that there'll be this additional release that helps keep things in balance.
What causes this release of CO2?
Minerals rich in reduced sulfur, like pyrite, it's also known as fool's gold, they react with oxygen, and it causes a reaction that produces strong acids, like sulfuric acid. Strong acids react with other minerals, and this leads to CO2 release.
Can you tell us about your research?
The project got started while we were doing some field work in Peru, and we noticed that the reaction of pyrite or fool's gold with oxygen was really important in this environment, but it was not important when we got down into the Amazon floodplain. So this motivated us to see, well, is that globally true? Does that exist in other environments? And so we took existing data for sites like the Himalayas, the mountains in Taiwan, and mountains in Canada, compiled it and found that, yes, it was sort of a global observation, that in mountain ranges you do have a lot of CO2 release because of the reaction of pyrite. And so we thought, well, if that's sort of important in the modern budget, would that be important over million-year timescales? So we looked at the record of marine rocks and their chemistry. This is a sensitive recorder of changes in ocean chemistry. And we sort of did some numerical computer models to compute how much pyrite was reacting over the course of the last 60 million years or so to sort of look at what effect it would have on the global carbon budget.
I know that there are other such sponges in the environment, such as the soil itself and, of course, trees and the ocean. Do these factors also have a self-regulating ability within them?
Yes, except it's all on different timescales. So the ocean, trees, and soils exchange carbon with the atmosphere on shorter timescales relative to what we're talking about, but still long timescales, sort of, you know, in the orders of thousands of years. Sort of looking at the exchange between the atmosphere and the rocks is maybe on the order of millions of years. So they all do affect the CO2, but on different characteristic timescales.
And finally, there's been a lot of concern lately, of course, about too much man-made atmospheric CO2 and other greenhouse gases. Does your theory indicate that Earth's natural climate regulator can also do the same with these current increasing levels of greenhouse gases?
Yes, but again, there's a timescale issue. So while Earth's natural cycles will sort of start interacting with our anthropogenic emissions, the timescale of these balancing, you know, reactions occurs over millions of years. So if we emit a bunch of CO2, we'll have to, you know, have it be in the atmosphere for a million years before anything happens. So all of the negative effects of anthropogenic emissions, like increased temperatures, ocean acidification, will still be a problem for humans. And so I think that's the main concern with the sort of anthropogenic emissions.
That was researcher Mark Torres from the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more, so stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.